Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gina Valeria, Assistant News Director at KGO Radio, lecturer at San Francisco State University in the Broadcast Department. Today's program is sponsored by Ernst & Young and the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and we will take a closer look at a scientific reawakening in the Middle East, how San Francisco's Exploratorium is working with countries across that region and elsewhere in the world to encourage this creation of inquiry-based learning environments and investment in knowledge education. Exploratorium Global Studios has brought exhibits to places such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere, with great success in connecting with the people there. Here to tell us more are Silver Ray, creator and director of business development for Exploratorium Global Studios, and Adam Tobin, managing director of Exploratorium Global Studios. Global Studios work to help foreign governments and public-private entities create these learning environments. They also build human capacity, transition to a more knowledge-based economy while respecting cultural and social conditions in the countries. Please welcome Silva Raker and Adam Tobin.
Thank you. I'd like to start by just speaking about the Exploratorium in general for a few moments. As many of you may know, we were founded right here in San Francisco in 1969 by Frank Oppenheimer. Frank was a research physicist who had worked on the Manhattan Project with his brother, J. Robert, and who opened this very new kind of museum in the midst of the counterculture movement here in San Francisco. As we sometimes say at the Exploratorium, or we like to say, science is too important to leave in the hands of only the scientists and the politicians. And our mission at the Exploratorium is to foster curiosity and science literacy throughout the world, and to fundamentally help create engaged citizens and critical thinkers. So that's an underlying important notion for our work that we'll discuss today. When you enter a monochromatic room at the Exploratorium, where everything, the color of your skin, the color of your hair, your clothes, the things around you change because you're in the presence of sodium vapor lamps that are emitting a single wavelength of light, when you explore how to make something that will fly out of strawberry baskets and toilet paper tubes, when you notice how the water of the bay that surrounds us is changing every single moment and running through a spectrum from gray to blue to green, and lots of colors in between, those are experiences that we're creating and cultivating at the Exploratorium. We're about playful exploration, about noticing what's happening in the natural world and wondering why. Direct experiences of scientific phenomena, and the belief that by having those, that people will feel empowered to ask and explore their own questions as a result, feeling that, you know, we're connected and we can explore that on our own rather than have someone tell us what it is or how it should be. We're more than a museum, much more. We think of ourselves as a learning laboratory. We've received more than $100 million in research and development grants since our founding more than 40 years ago. $75 million of those dollars have come straight from the National Science Foundation. And we've used those dollars to create exhibits and programs and to assemble a talented staff, all of which we now share around the world, as well as here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Our museum floor is an ongoing experiment where all of the visitors are participants. We like to say that the exhibits are nothing to themselves. They come alive when you interact with them, and it's what's happening in that moment that is what we're about. It's that learning. And we say that we are never done in this work, which is why you see a robust exhibit workshop at the heart of our floor, where changes and modifications to exhibits, where we're experimenting with public programs, et cetera, that's our ongoing work. What you may not know is that in addition to the work that's happening here in San Francisco, that we have actually been part of a global movement. We've been at the forefront of a global movement toward participatory science learning. That's generated more than 800 science centers and museums around the world over the last four decades. Almost all of these museums contain Exploratorium-designed exhibits. Many of them also have programs, such as our High School Explainer program that were first launched here in San Francisco, and many other programs that we've developed here in San Francisco. It's always been part of our mission to share and disseminate the work that we do and to continue our own learning by collaborating and working with others. Exploratorium Global Studios, as Gina mentioned, is part of a bold new commitment and initiative to expand that work that I'd like to ask my colleague Adam Tobin, who's leading that charge, to tell you more about.
Well, so early in the Exploratorium's history, it was an influencer, as Silva mentioned, of a burgeoning science center movement around the world. And early on, it was the exhibits, first and foremost, and obviously, that people were interested in. So the Exploratorium's exhibits were replicated in different museums and settings around the world. And early in the Exploratorium's history, institutions, governments, other museums would come to the Exploratorium and ask us explicitly if we would partner with them, perhaps fabricating our own exhibits or sharing the designs. So a group was born that was dedicated towards propagating the work of the Exploratorium out into the wider world. And it started primarily, as I said, with the exhibits. Now, over time, that actually grew into not just the exhibits, but the approach of the Exploratorium, the culture of the Exploratorium, the intellectual capital of the Exploratorium. And over the last number of years, particularly in the context of our recent move to the Piers in downtown San Francisco, we've expanded the way in which we partner with outside agencies and institutions. In fact, we've expanded the nature and breadth of those institutions and settings to include governments, to include sometimes corporations, other nonprofits, NGOs. And in the last number of years, the move has provided the Exploratorium with perhaps its most generative, creative period since its founding. It was an opportunity for us to learn. It was an opportunity for us to grow, explore new ways of collaborating with the wider community and the wider world. And in the midst of this, this group called Global Studios was born, building on the work in the past of providing exhibits and other experiences to institutions around the world. Global Studios was founded to explicitly propagate who we are and what we create to the wider world. And we've participated in the form of partnerships, in terms of networks. Our global reach, interestingly enough, was there from the early days of the institution. Many of the first institutions that contacted us were worldwide. One of our early projects was in Beijing, doing exhibitions for Sony, a partner. About 5 years ago, we were first contacted by a group in Egypt. And this is the dawn of some of our more recent work in the Middle East. Interestingly enough, it was the municipality and an agency that was focused on irrigation and water. But they were interested in exhibits from the Exploratorium. So we ended up working with them, providing about 100 exhibits, and not only providing the exhibits, but providing professional development in the form of training for their staff and their organization. And that began, without us necessarily knowing that it was coming, a whole new wave of work and interest in the Middle East. Since then, we've worked in Turkey, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. And the way in which we've worked with our partners there has been very, very interesting, and it's been very, very diverse. The reasons why, we don't entirely know. We don't pretend to know why or what it's related to, but there has been a rise of interest in education, particularly informal science education. We've heard explicitly that there are economies that are oil-based that are wanting to move towards being technology or information-based, and they see education as a pathway, specifically science education. So we actually, instead of talking in broader terms, we'd actually like to talk about two specific examples that we chose as a way of illustrating the way in which we're working in the region. And we chose one in Saudi Arabia, which is a specific program where we brought a tinkering studio, one of our own programs, in a particular event, to Turkey, where we're participating in a much broader way on a national level with a broad national commitment to informal science education, where they're building 81 new science centers, a scale of which we've never seen and we don't think has existed before in terms of dedicating national resources specifically for informal science education. So I'll actually start by talking about the Saudi Arabia project, one of our Saudi Arabia projects, which was to bring a tinkering studio to a cultural festival in Al Khobar, Saudi Arabia. This was last summer. And basically our tinkering studio, very briefly, is an educational team that we have at the Exploratorium that believes in learner-directed, self-directed learning and exploration through hands-on making, exploration with materials, forming your own questions, different in many ways than what you think of as typical making in a museum, where it might be something more like make and take or an engineering challenge. This is really about finding your own interest level and your own questions through making. So we were partnering with Saudi Aramco, the national oil company in Saudi Arabia, which was funding the project, and a local new group called Talents, which was a nascent education company in Al Khobar. Together, we worked to bring a tinkering studio to this cultural program. And now what this was basically imagine a series of tents that are erected almost in the middle of nowhere in a matter of days, and then tens of thousands of people come to what would be this science festival. So we sent over around 15, 16 people to build this environment, this tinkering studio, and not only to build a studio and then leave, they actually were training 16 facilitators on the ground who would then travel with this studio that we created around Saudi Arabia in the interest of us not showing up and just providing a program, but basically providing the professional development and the capacity building necessary for the local community to own this program and build on it. It was a very interesting program. There were many stories about arriving in Saudi Arabia when it's about 115, 120 degrees in a non-air-conditioned tent, building this studio, and then meeting with local educators, local students, and conducting workshops with them on how they might work with the visitors at this festival to do something that many of them had never, ever done before, which would be this kind of self-directed learning. And it was a profoundly meaningful experience for everyone, including ourselves. We learned so much by doing this because in many ways it was in a different cultural setting. There were different expectations. And one of the reasons we do this work is not necessarily just to bring this thing that we know somewhere, but to provide an opportunity for us to learn about that thing that we do. And it was that. That tinkering studio now moved on to a museum in Riyadh called Mishkat, which is part of a new science center movement writ large in Saudi Arabia. And they are now traveling this around. And some of the trainers that we trained are now training other trainers and other facilitators as this grows throughout Saudi Arabia. So that's one example of the kind of work that we've been doing. A second example would be our work in Turkey.
And I'll speak to that. So in November 2011, the Minister of Science, Technology, and Industry, Nihat Ergun of Turkey, visited the Exploratorium. And shortly after returning back home to Turkey, there was a broad announcement from the Turkish national government that this initiative was put in place to build 81 science centers between now and 2023, which would be the 100th anniversary of Ataturk's, the creation of the Republic of Turkey. So that was an interesting conjunction. When the minister was here, he spent time in Silicon Valley as well, and a very stated goal of this initiative is to increase public interest in science and to prepare Turkey to participate in, or expand their participation in a knowledge-based economy and innovation, kind of the innovation and creativity economy that we hear about from various governments as we travel around the world. That opened up a dialogue between the Exploratorium and TÜBİTAK. TÜBİTAK is the analog to the National Science Foundation in Turkey. And we ended up working on one of the two seminal projects that form the foundation for this initiative, which is rolling out over several years. That process, and maybe we'll get more into it during the Q&A, of the dialogue with TÜBİTAK, we felt there was a turning point because you might imagine that folks in our industry, if it's an industry, the science center field, are all very interested in what's happening in Turkey, given the boldness of their initiative. The moment at which we felt there was a breakthrough in our relationship with TÜBİTAK was when we said, we're not here to sell you things, we're here to help you build your own. And let us, we're interested in working with you to do that, to build, because it's not just about buildings and exhibits and in our travels. Some of those 800 science centers I referenced are busy collecting dust, unfortunately. The successful ones engage the community, are based on people and programs and not just the physical exhibits and the environment. So it's our passionate commitment that when we're out doing this work, we're trying to bring the whole recipe of the place. And help that local community modify it as appropriate for their culture and their goals. So based on those conversations, we were awarded work on the Kocaeli Science Center, which is, as I mentioned, the first of two. Kocaeli is a major province in Turkey directly east of Istanbul. And the site for the science center is in İzmit, which is the capital of that province. It sits on the Sea of Marmara. It's a beautiful location, and there are some interesting parallels to our peers' location. The site is an old paper mill. It was built in the 1930s by Atatürk. It was the first nationalized industry in Turkey, so it has great historical significance, as well as architectural. It was the largest steel structure at the time that it was built. It's a German Bauhaus architecture, so it's part of that 1930s worker industrialization movement. It's been lying dormant now for a couple of decades. And so there's a vision to take this old paper mill and turn it into a collection of museums for the public, with the Science Center being the very first one that will open there, and it's scheduled to open now in spring of 2014. So we've worked with a team from İzmit as well as TÜBİTAK, based in Ankara, to complete a master plan for that science center, and we're now in the midst of the design phase and helping them plan for their programs and operations. And just this week, we've received a request to submit a proposal for the second science center in Konya, a very different community that we have a lot to learn about, frankly, that's more in the interior of Turkey. And we've been asked to help plan the programs and operations for that science center, which will open in December of this year. So what we love about what's happening in Turkey and our relationship to that is that we are able to have a conversation at the national level that we hope will lead to some investment that's of a more centralized nature for professional development and program development that can then be leveraged across Turkey rather than each of these science centers, which should, of course, be rooted in their own communities, but also have access to these resources that are more than exhibits. And we, being in the conversation at the national level and being part of that work is tremendously exciting to us. That's always been part of what we do at the Exploratorium, too, is to build networks and share knowledge. We built a very vibrant one here in the United States, which we could also talk about, but we'll save that for another day. So I think that's an example between Saudi Arabia and Turkey. As Adam mentioned, we've worked in several other countries, and the number of inquiries that we continue to field from Qatar, Kuwait, Palestine, Israel, it's definitely weekly. It's almost daily, it feels, in some cases.
It is, and it's interesting that it's not all top down. We talk a lot about how we're working with the governments. It's bottom up, it's top down. We're getting requests that would come directly from the governments, directly from ministries, directly from municipalities and provinces, directly from scientists, educators at universities, professors, local community stakeholders, business people. It's this very interesting convergence that seems to be happening. Whether it's orchestrated or organic, we don't know. But it's coming at us from all corners, sometimes in a coordinated way. Sometimes we'll have, you know, someone from the government or the municipality or a local professor at a university all asking us about the same thing, not even necessarily knowing that they're all asking us about the same thing. So it's been quite fascinating, intriguing, and exciting from our perspective.
So I think we're almost ready for the Q&A. We'll just add a couple of things. I think it's we want to emphasize that this is not about exporting our what we do here exactly. It's about translation and collaboration and really and our own learning as we go out and work in the world and the marvelous opportunities that this affords us to do that. We have internal dialogues about how might we be culturally stereotyping, how like really focusing on that and thinking about the work as we bring it, that it's not us bringing education to a place. In fact, I'm sure as some of you know, the Middle East was the home of an incredible golden age of science, you know, 1,000 years ago or so. And they're, when we work with folks there, they're well aware of that and interested in connecting to that history and maybe bringing that back into play in a different sort of way. And also it is about growing the impact of the Exploratorium as a movement, as an idea, rather than simply a physical location in one, albeit wonderful, city here in the United States. And one other point as we head into the Q&A, just we want to be sure that we're not misrepresenting ourselves. We're not foreign policy experts. We're educators, scientists, learners, and that's what we're speaking from today. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you so much. Excuse me. I want to thank to I'd love to thank Silva Raker, creator and director of business development for the Exploratorium Global Studies, and Adam Tobin, managing director of Exploratorium Global Studies, and to remind you that this program today is sponsored by Ernst & Young and the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. I'm Gina Bellaria, and I have some great questions up here, and if anybody else in the audience has any questions they'd like to ask, send them my way. I want to start, first of all, just asking a few more questions about what you just discussed. Tell me a little bit about when you get to these countries, and I think I'd want to start with Saudi Arabia. When you get to these countries, who's bringing you there, first of all? And what is your experience like as you first begin to interact with people?
That's a great question. It's funny, when you asked that, I was just conjuring up this image in my mind when I first got out of the airport in Dammam, Saudi Arabia, you know, at midnight, having just flown there from Istanbul, and I'm in a very different place all of a sudden. And I think a lot of us, when we went there, we had that same experience. But I can say to a person that the reception we received from everybody was always incredibly warm. It was very welcoming. It was very collegial. We felt like we had found other family members in terms of people who are interested in education almost across the board. And the people who brought us there, specifically to Saudi Arabia, was a combination of the Saudi Aramco people who were behind the entire initiative, and this small local startup had a very entrepreneurial feel, this company called Talents, which was an education company. So they were the ones welcoming us there. And it was right from the beginning, there was a sense of kindred spirit, and at least what the goals would be of bringing this kind of educational approach.
And on that note, so you had similar goals, and I'm wondering, wonderful that you were both kindred spirits, but were there any missteps along the way, culturally, communicative, and how did you navigate that?
Of course there were. And, you know, I can speak personally. I realized I was pronouncing one of my counterpart's names incorrectly for about 4 months before he indirectly told me how to pronounce it correctly. There were little things like that, but always in a good spirit. I think a lesson for us, though, is you may come in with assumptions, just being people, about what to expect, that it might be that different or it might be this way or that way. And inevitably, wherever we went, and this includes Saudi Arabia, we found that there was a much richer narrative in terms of culture. It was way more diverse than you could have possibly hoped to imagine until you're there on the ground, from a number of different perspectives. So the notion that it would be one way or a certain way when you got there turned out not to be the case at all. That, I think, was a wonderful learning experience for us, perhaps even more so than other regions we've worked in. I mean, it forced us to be more attuned both to the differences that you might or might not expect, and to the differences that are indeed there as you begin to navigate. It became very quickly less about culture and more about people.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. And so I want to dive into that culture assumptions argument. And so for me anyway, I think of Saudi Arabia and I think, oh, are they letting their young girls do this? Are there women you're working with? What is that like? And forgive me for being so, having such lack of education, but I'm really curious. What was that like?
That's a great question. And, I'll be honest, when we first contemplated, this work in Saudi Arabia, that was indeed an internal conversation at the Exploratorium. It was, we knew that there would be a different treatment of gender, mm-hmm. Part of the culture, and not necessarily the same way that we do it here. I know, of course, that's an understatement. So what do we do with that, right? Do we go, even, because of that? And in the end, the answer was, of course, yes. And the reason it was yes is that we are not about judging one culture or another or one norm or another, that we believe that what we bring to the table is an approach, a way of thinking, critical thinking, creating your own questions. And then it's up to people to do with that what they will. And we did have one, stipulation, you could say, though, in that yes that we ultimately gave is, however it happened, working within and respecting the culture, we wanted to make sure that we were indeed able to work with both boys and girls, mm-hmm. men and women, that if we were to go there, it would not be providing it to just half of the population. And that did indeed turn out to be the case. So when we provided our experiences, we were not only providing them to boys and girls, men and women, but we were actually training young men and young women to be the facilitators as the program moved throughout Saudi Arabia.
Oh, that's excellent. You know, we talked before the program and a little bit during your talk about this isn't something you just want to go and slap on another country. This isn't some sort of that you do it this way. You want to make it a partnership and a dialogue. So tell me, from both of you and your experiences with this program in general, what were some of the biggest discoveries that you felt the countries you worked with brought to the program, or some of the things that delighted you, surprised you, or you thought were beautiful additions to the global initiative?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I can answer a little bit from both Turkey and Saudi Arabia. From the Saudi Arabian partners that we had, there was just this raw energy. It was a lot of youth that we were working with. The agencies that we were working with had a real startup feel, both the museum Mishkat that I mentioned, where we continue to work with them to do professional development and teacher professional development, and this talents group. There was this this hunger and this thirst to be doing what they were doing, which was wonderful to see. And to be clear, a deep knowledge base. It wasn't like we were going in and coming in with all kinds of answers and notions that they didn't have. Folks were incredibly worldly. They were up to date on the latest blogs, thinking, innovations, gadgets, pedagogy. they were talking about the Exploratorium almost as well as we do. And it was, that was extraordinary. And in Turkey, with some of our initial partners that we had from the municipality of Kocaeli, there was a level of science expertise that was brought to the table. So the folks that we were dealing with were PhDs in, I think it was astrophysics was one, another was physics. And so it was immediately, just as we had hoped and as Silva outlined, it was a two-way street. And then what we learn in particular is the, it's almost like a rekindling of our own spirit. You know, again, in the context of the move, it wasn't a coincidence that we're relooking at ourselves and thinking about how we move forward and adapt and change. What a gift to be able to work with these institutions and individuals who are doing it from the ground up on their own. And I think in dialogue with them, they helped us understand how simultaneously, if they're to build something new in their own countries, they wouldn't necessarily do exactly what we've done before, and they're going to come up with new ways of doing things. And boy, shouldn't we be doing the same thing as we recreate ourselves here in San Francisco?
I would add to that two things. I think one of our biggest areas of learning was challenging our own notions and preconceived ideas about the region and countries. Of course, it's not monolithic. There are huge variations between the countries we've worked in and even within those countries. And as Americans, we're probably a little retrograde compared to maybe the rest of the world in terms of thinking beyond our own borders. So that, although we're, I think, somewhat worldly at the Exploratorium, I think that on a personal level, that was an area of rich learning for everyone who was involved. I've forgotten my second point. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. If you remember it, let me know. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, sponsored today by Ernst & Young and the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. We're talking with Silva Raker, creator and director of business development for Exploratorium Global Studios, and Adam Tobin, managing director of Exploratorium Global Studios. I'm Gina Valeria. Silva, I'd like to actually ask you, too, about some of your experiences connecting with different cultures. I know we focused on Saudi Arabia, but tell me about Turkey or another country that you felt was rich with surprises or differences, and how you first entered and what your interactions were like with some of the people you worked with.
Well, Turkey is such a fascinating place, and I suspect there are folks in the audience who maybe know more about it than we do. It's such a nexus, a bridge between cultures, just instantly sitting as it does on the borders with Europe, Asia, the Middle East. It's kind of all three of those within the country. It's a secular government, but 95% or so Muslim. And when you walk through the streets of Istanbul or you go to some of the outlying areas, you see so many different kinds of people, people who look different, people who dress differently, people who are educated and worldly, as Adam said. So I think that working with that mixture and having a sense of being in a very important intersection for the world and as well as the region is incredibly exciting and feels meaningful in terms of the work that we're doing. I applaud the government of Turkey for that investment in terms of thinking with a very long view making these kinds of experiences and participatory scientific education available throughout the country, really thinking of that as a long-term benefit for economically, but also for the country as a whole, is an amazing opportunity for us to participate in this kind of grand experiment, but also that kind of thinking, it's something that sometimes we come home and we compare some of the challenges we're dealing with, say, in California with education, and we wish for more of that long view and more of that kind of investment.
Well, that's great. A couple of questions from the audience. Has there been any opposition to your programs in the various countries that you've connected with, and how have you addressed this? And on a similar note, did you have any problems with religious entities in Saudi Arabia or any of the other countries?
The answer to the first question is, to our knowledge, no. we haven't personally experienced any opposition, quite the opposite. Like I was saying, top to bottom, individual to institution. It's largely been celebrating the fact that this is happening. Religious opposition, no, not as such, but of course, being in Saudi Arabia, it was very present. And I can say that that was one of the areas in which we were able to witness some of the, as I said, the plurality of culture, if not just below the surface, right on it. There was a number of instances while we were working at the cultural festival in Al-Khobar, which was, as I said before, it was mixed gender, that it was both men and women participating in the program, and not just with the Exploratorium. Because this was under the umbrella, if you will, of Saudi Aramco, which might be perhaps a little more liberal in its views, but still in Saudi Arabia. So there were moments where the religious police would actually come to the festival, and somehow folks in the festival would know, and there would be a moment where people would segregate, the religious police would walk through, they would leave, and then people would come back together. There was one evening where they actually closed the festival because either there was a greater presence or something else was going on. We really didn't know, and we were kind of witnessing and glimpsing. But that was us getting a sense of some of the natural tensions, if you will, in the culture. And again, the fact that there was a lot going on just below the surface. Now, none of that ever manifested as opposition to the programs that we were bringing or to the fact that there was education going on, to be clear. But it was certainly something that our educators on the ground had to learn how to navigate, and navigate respectfully.
That is fascinating. How about you?
I was going to tell the same story, so I won't repeat it.
Okay, that's fair. Okay, you mentioned, Silva, some exhibits are collecting dust in some countries, whereas other countries, these exhibits are still making the rounds and people are still experiencing them. Can you talk a little bit about where it hasn't been so successful and why that might be versus why it might be more successful in other places?
I don't know if I'd call out specific locations or municipalities, sure. But in, even in countries where we're being invited to come and work and collaborate, one of the things we do, of course, is we explore and survey what's there already. And so in doing so, in the Emirates, for example, there are examples of science centers that were built maybe 10 years ago, and you visit and they're empty. And they're perhaps they contain a more didactic exhibit approach, more, you know, dioramas with lots of words and not so interactive, or maybe they're just kind of, they were done as someone's pet project versus really being situated in the center of a community and really connected to the community in a way that where it will grow and thrive and create experiences in the way we do here and where we foster it elsewhere. So I actually think that you can find examples of that everywhere. I don't think it's unique to, you know, the Middle East or a particular country. I think that there's quite a range. And maybe some of you have had experiences in science centers out there. So it's not, there are very many different ways to approach the material. So, and our strong belief, where we operate, is in this notion of participatory, inquiry-based, open-ended, and that's what we try to share out.
Are there specific exhibits within the display that are more successful that you find people universally gravitate toward, or anything like that?
You know, Exploratorium exhibits, and Adam, as the former director of exhibit development at the Exploratorium, can probably speak more eloquently to this, but they are actually built with that social interaction in mind. So they're not designed for one person pushing a button. They're designed for, depending on the exhibit, because they do range anywhere from two or three on up to a dozen people standing around the turntable. Maybe some of you have experienced this exhibit, which has a big rotating disc in the middle, and we put shapes on it. And it's so great to walk out and see how people, perfect strangers, are interacting and kind of experimenting together, you know, with different shapes or asking questions. So we believe that that's part of the vibrancy and part of the learning, is to have that social aspect incorporated. So
Yeah, I know that the last time I visited the New Exploratorium recently, and the exhibit in the back on the left where you have to walk quietly like through the rocks, which is so much fun, by the way, because no one can do it. And the line was, I mean, we waited forever, and we were so excited to do it. And other exhibits, you have one or two, you have a few people waiting. So I'm wondering sort of what excites people in other countries.
Well, it's interesting. First, you bring up that exhibit. It happens to be one of my personal favorites. It's called Out Quiet Yourself, and it was part of our listening project a number of years ago, an NSF-funded project. I would actually say one of the reasons that I think that exhibit is so interesting, it's a great exemplar of our own exhibit development process, which is the exhibit developers play with content areas and things that interest them. And that joy and interest and curiosity that is part of their creative process is what comes across, hopefully, for the visitor. Mm-hmm. And we iterate, as Silva said before, we're never done. We're constantly iterating. And that exhibit went through a number of different iterations. And in some ways, it was a little bit of a departure for us, that it is something that does create a line, for example, and is something that one person goes through as they do. And yet it's still such a wonderful experience. How the exhibits are perceived in other countries, I don't know that it's different, quite honestly. I don't think that we've seen it's this type of exhibit here or that type of exhibit there. And I think that's hopefully a credit to the exhibit development process, which again is about human curiosity, and not meant to be taken in the context of any one place or time or culture. The exhibit developers who create those exhibits, they basically are creating props, as they were originally called in our founding, or experiments that feel accessible, that don't feel that, you know, they're trying to tell you something or project something to you. They're basically an open invitation to experiment, to play, to learn. And from that standpoint, we hope that they are culturally universal.
That's exciting to hear that there is a shared experience, because when I went through that particular exhibit, I was thinking, oh, we Americans were so impatient, we won't possibly take the time to go through the, anyways, I don't know if that exhibit exists anywhere else, but it's nice to hear that the things that delight and surprise us here would also delight, surprise, or inform people in other places. I want to talk a little bit about, and understanding that you're not political scientists, but that you are interacting with other nations at a time when the Arab Spring has led to other uprisings, protests, unrest, things happening in various different countries. Has this at all impacted your work or your ability or desires to go to a certain place?
It has. You know, we watch the news closely. We recently changed some plans to travel based on three weeks ago, the elevated alerts from the State Department. We haven't explicitly said we won't work in any one place. We were actually in Tunisia last year, and we traveled to some places that maybe would some people might characterize as being a little edgier than others. But we try to follow the news and be aware of it. And, of course, we're always concerned about the safety of our staff. And also, I'd say there is a desire on the part of the Exploratorium that we won't – it's not that we'll just go work anywhere. We're looking for partners who are in it for the long term and who share our goals, our long-term goals – of creating, you know, engaged citizens and critical thinkers. And that doesn't happen in 6 months or a year or even 2 years. So when we think about where we'll invest our time and talent, we're looking for some stability and sense that will be able to grow forward. None of that's something you can predict perfectly, but that's an aspect we take into account.
And I would add, interestingly enough, all of the events that are so prominent in the news and obviously so big and tectonic have not necessarily been part of our conversations with our partners over there. It's been really interesting. We, as curious people, we wonder what the connections are. We wonder if there are connections indeed to what we're seeing and the larger events. But the conversations we have tend to be focused very constructively on the future, as Silva said, with the long view about education. It's always been looking to some point in the future where economies have shifted, youth are educated and interested in science, and it's always been wrapped in that context. Rarely, if ever, even in our conversations with governments, is it wrapped in a political context.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, sponsored today by Ernst & Young and the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. We are talking with Silva Raker, creator and director of business development for the Exploratorium Global Studios, and Adam Tobin, managing director of Exploratorium Global Studios. I'm Gina Bellaria. We have a few more questions and a little bit of time left, so if anybody has any other questions, bring them on up or hand them to the volunteer. So I want to talk a little bit about back here. We have one question from the audience. It sounds like the U.S. could use 80 science centers. So you're focusing overseas. What about here in the U.S.?
In fact, I think we have more than 80 science centers in the United States. And I couldn't tell you the exact number, but I think that was more of a nod to perhaps our investment in education overall than science centers per se. And that's obviously a major topic here in the United States and California. And as a parent of two teenagers, one that's near and dear to my heart.
It's interesting. We've had some of our partners in the Middle East express direct concern about our education system. There was a very interesting moment where we're out to dinner with one of our partners, a person of some influence, and he was saying, as we were talking about how great it was that they were investing with such a long view and with, lucky for them, such resources, his concern was what happens to our education system here in the United States, which has been a model over time for many on the positive side, but he was concerned looking forward. And that was a very, talk about a learning moment that, you know, we're
it's humbling.
It was very humbling. Mm. And it was quite eye-opening to, have somebody else help us look in the mirror in such a way.
Yeah. I think that was a couple of years ago, you know, before the state budget got a little healthier here in California. And he was literally saying, why aren't you marching in the streets? And we were sort of saying, well, we're doing what we can. We are working for a nonprofit educational institution devoted to to learning. Good example.
I can see that, and I think today level, you see things happening in the news and focus, but you're right, the idea of somebody turning the mirror back on you can. So on that note, is the Exploratorium working on any programs here in the U.S.? And I know you have students come to the Exploratorium, etc. Talk a little bit about your work to connect students with science education here in the U.S.
Well, we work in a variety of ways. I'll mention a couple programs. Our high school explainer program, which is a fabulous and longstanding program at the Exploratorium that's been employed or modeled for the rest of the world. I believe, and Leslie maybe will correct me if I've got this wrong, that we're currently the largest employer of teenagers in San Francisco. Many folks might not know that, but Frank Oppenheimer, early on, I think 1970 or so is when the program started, felt strongly that the best floor staff would be people who were enthusiastic, asking their own questions, and not necessarily experts or authorities, but people who would be engaged in this collaborative social process, and that teenagers who were interested in science were the best possible candidates for this. And so began a program that both staffs the floor and also is really a youth development program. And they receive training every day. And it's one of our best and most successful and fabulous programs. People who go through that program are changed by it, and we differentially serve. I think 80% of the kids in that program come from underserved neighborhoods in San Francisco, so that's a key component of it. Another example, and very important one, also coming from the early days of the Exploratorium, is working with teachers, and our teacher training programs are very robust and well-developed. I think we've hosted more than 6,000 teachers in workshops over the years, and these are in-depth, multi-week programs that are about inquiry-based learning. We have an institute, the Teacher Institute, which focuses on science teachers in the middle and high school levels, and we have another institute, the Institute for Inquiry, that works primarily with elementary school teachers. And those programs, people come from all over the world to participate. They're richly connected to schools throughout California and the Bay Area. And it's our belief that by working with teachers who will interact with thousands of students over the course of their career, that there's a wonderful multiplier effect and a way of kind of taking this other way of learning out to many thousands of kids in the world.
Wonderful. So. We have one audience member asking, is there a vision for student-scholar exchange programs, ambassadorship opportunities, et cetera? Don't know if you've thought about that.
That's a great idea. We've done teacher exchanges. We have yet to do student exchanges.
Excellent. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the two of you and how you got involved in the Exploratorium and the Global Exchange. So Silva, first, you have a history of developing global programs for general audiences. It seems like you're always trying to connect with the world at large, at least from your bio. That's sort of what I took out of it. What led you to this work, and what are you most proud of in the work that you've done to this point in your career?
Well, I started out as a field biologist, so science was an early love of mine. I landed in business completely unexpectedly, kind of in between graduate school and undergraduate, working for the Nature Company based in Berkeley that was also had a science-oriented mission, certainly an understanding and appreciation of nature. And what I learned there is that business is its own ecology. That's what, as I learned more about that and thought about, I discovered that I was quite interested and had some aptitude, and that this was a way to have an impact in the world in a positive way. So I spent about 25 years in the for-profit sector, working with three companies primarily, including most recently a travel company, so a strong global connection. And then 3 years ago, decided that I wanted to make the move into the nonprofit world, and was blessed to have the opportunity to join the Exploratorium at this amazing time, about 2 years prior to our move to the Piers. And with that move to the Piers really being seen as a platform, of course it's a wonderful new site and a building, but it's also a platform for this global impact and ongoing work of the Exploratorium. So I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to join. And I would say that the most meaningful work I've ever done is the work I'm doing now.
Excellent. Excellent. And then Adam, yeah, you're a toy maker, which is so exciting. And in case nobody's read his bio, I have. And basically started out with masking tape and other materials around the house to create toys, which I think is so cool. So tell me, you're at the Exploratorium now. How did you get interested in the Exploratorium, and what work are you most proud of?
Yes, I've been a tinkerer and maker my entire life. Did design educational toys for a while, and had launched a couple of small toy manufacturing companies. The Exploratorium, when I moved out to the Bay Area about 20 years ago, anybody who knew me said, Adam, there's this place you have to go see. And I did, and here I am. So I would also agree. I'm proud of many things I've done in my career, but the work that we're doing right now is an extraordinary opportunity, and the reach that we have, the ability to connect, and in our particular group, the ability to connect worldwide, it's a really special moment in time that I hope continues for a while.
Yeah. I do want to ask about, we have a couple questions from the audience. Recently in the news, we found out that the Exploratorium had to let go of a few people as they transition into this new space. So, how's everybody doing over there, and has the Global Studios been affected by this? What now is the vision for moving the place forward? I know that's a lot of questions, but I thought I'd ask.
Sure. Thanks for asking. We have undergone some reduction in positions, not because of poor attendance, but actually our attendance has been great. We've grown tremendously in our move to the Piers, and that's always been our goal in that move, was to increase access, be more accessible to the East Bay, the South Bay, and we're seeing our audiences double, actually more than double in the new location, so we're quite pleased about that. However, you know, there have been the projections that we had were higher, and because of that, we have had to make some cuts. We're doing okay with that. It's a sad time for folks who just went through this magnificent project to be leaving, but we're working through it. And I'm a little hesitant here, but to clarify, maybe some of the local press coverage, there were some inaccuracies. It's more, it's a little less than 8% of staff, mm-hmm. not 18%. The 18% figure was based on open positions that hadn't been filled, other sorts of reductions. And so it is, of course, a serious and something we'd prefer not to be doing, but not quite the magnitude that maybe has been reported. And in terms of Global Studios, I think the reductions are associated with the reorganization that actually it supports this work boldly. I think our platform for continuing this work becomes stronger through those changes. So,
thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And on that note, on that note, where does Global Studios go from here? We've got a couple questions. Are you planning to go to Morocco, Cuba? what other countries are you thinking of? What's the plan from this moment forward?
That's a great question. It's interesting right now. I'm going to give a non-answer, if that's okay, that we've been largely reactive. Not necessarily the best model you would think on the surface, but the truth is the Exploratorium is so well known in so many places. The way that we often determine where to go is by wisely, hopefully, choosing from the people who contact us. So it wasn't like somebody in our group was smart enough to say, I think the Middle East is going to become an area of interest and renaissance in science education, so let's go there. It really came to us, and hopefully we recognized it and worked gracefully within the request that we were getting. That said, we've had a presence in Europe for some time, well-established partnerships. We also have well-established partnerships in Asia, though there are similar movements going on there. Both Silva and I were recently in Korea for a regional science center conference, and you see some parallels there in the way that there is large-scale investment on a government level. Places like China, of course, are building science centers left and right. Also South America, I think, is an area where we would be interested in working, where there's opportunity there for growth. And I would express a personal interest, though we haven't figured out how to do it, in Africa. Often overlooked in these conversations, and I think a great opportunity for science education, just are there the right partners and the right infrastructure for us to work with? We don't know, but we're interested in a number of different areas.
And I'll just add, closer to home, we're very excited about projects such as one we have going with UCSF right now. We're working on exhibits for the new Benioff Children's Hospital and creating learning environments there, not only for the kids who are in the hospital for extended periods, but for their families who are visiting, and how to create a healing environment and how this kind of learning can be part of that. And even across the bay in Emeryville, looking at commercial public spaces like the Emeryville Public Market, how to bring these exhibit experiences and programs to those locations. So that's fun and interesting, too, in addition to all these exotic international locations.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. We have reached the point in our program where it is time to quit and say goodbye. Our thanks to Silva Raker, creator and director of business development for Exploratorium Global Studios, Adam Tobin, managing director of Exploratorium Global Studios. This program today has been sponsored by the Gordon and Betty Morris Foundation and Ernst & Young. We thank our audiences here on the radio and on the internet. I'm Gina Bellaria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.